Welcome to the Winter Wonderland edition of Political Rewind. We're here in the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Midtown Atlanta and across Metro Atlanta. Although fortunately for those of you who are in other parts of the state, you're not experiencing it. The snow has been coming down for a couple of hours, and Jim Galloway is with me, and he's showing me the map. It looks like it's going to keep going for quite a while, Mr. Galloway.
You called it the Winter Wonderland edition. I was going to call it the Alfred E. Packard edition.
Tell me what that means.
When we get hungry, we're going to have to decide which one of us is going to be eaten.
Oh, the Donner Party. okay. Because there is a lot of snow and traffic out there has been horrendous here in the Atlanta area, we've given our panelists a break today. We have told them that they should get home, be safe and warm with their families. But Jim Galloway is a 30-plus year veteran journalist, and he'll go out in any weather to report on politics.
Me and my little pickup truck.
So you and I, Jim, will talk about all of the really interesting news that we have to discuss today. And thank you for being with us. You have a long drive when you get out of here, all the way up to the northern reaches of California.
Yeah. Well, my wife already is already telling me that I won't be able to drive into the subdivision.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So, Jim, let's get started. We, of course, had a big mayor's race here in Atlanta this week, and the news is probably starting to come to a slow end, but there is still some news going on in this race. Just yesterday, Mary Norwood, who almost certainly is going to lose the election, she may demand a recount. The election will be certified on Monday, and it's right at that point she'll have an opportunity to declare that she wants a recount because it's within the 1%, 759 mm-hmm. votes required for a recount. But the chances of turning around 759 votes are very slim, aren't they?
In a computer-based election machine system, no.
So we kind of assume that Keisha Lance Bottoms will be the next mayor of Atlanta. But Norwood is not going out quietly, Jim. What did she do as recently as yesterday?
Yeah, this was early yesterday afternoon. She put out a tweet saying that she had people coming up to her saying that they had bureaucratic problems and voter intimidation problems, and she was soliciting more complaints through Twitter, directing people to Brian Kemp, Secretary of State Brian Kemp's website, his voter fraud website.
So far, if I'm correct, she has not at least publicly produced any evidence of her claim.
No. That's kind of why I think this is just a terrible move on her part. Is, you know, if you have a complaint, then bring it forward and let people actually see it. But otherwise, it smacks of sour grapes.
Yeah. And what's interesting about this is it's a scenario that played out in 2009 when she lost to Kasim Reed by even fewer votes, 709 votes.
714
14,
votes.
Okay,
And 714. And it's a scenario she said played out.
Well, I mean that. She made a similar accusation
back in June in an address to the Buckhead Young Republicans that she didn't make anywhere else. She said that the Kasim Reed campaign had engaged in some questionable practices before and after balloting.
And it was in that talk in Buckhead that she used the term that Keisha Lance Bottoms kept
the thugs.
punishing her with, talking about thugs who interfered with that election.
Right. And it was a mistake for her to do that as well.
Talking essentially coded racial
right.
Conversation, and it became a big issue in our debate here. At GPB just before the election day on Tuesday. So we'll watch to see on Monday the certification of the results in both Atlanta and the Atlanta section of DeKalb County. Excuse me, and we'll see where Mary Norwood goes from there. But, Jim, you had a really, I thought, As long as we're talking mayor's race, you were not able to be with us on the day after the election. You had a fascinating analysis of this race in a paper on yesterday, I think, or Wednesday?
Thursday. Okay. Thursday's paper, yeah.
Atlanta mayoral runoff as a mirror image, essentially, of Trumpian politics. What do you mean by that?
By that, I mean, look, Mary Norwood was running a campaign of the middle. She was neither Republican nor Democrat, and she was trying to create this coalition, a bipartisan, biracial coalition. And my point was that we are in a very harsh political climate. We are in a climate of extremes. And in a climate like that, number one, your electorate isn't willing to give up what it already has. It's not a climate for gambling. So number one, I think African Americans who are in control of the city politics were kind of skeptical of that. But what it also did is it allowed the Keisha Lance Bottoms and her campaigners, who I'm assuming included Mayor Kasim Reed, to conduct a campaign that was very much like Republicans are doing right now under Trump, in that it is wholly based on party identity, a large part on racial identity, and it worked. It worked.
Yeah. Certainly the mayor must have been thrilled to hear you compare him to President Trump.
No, I don't think so. But in my own defense, let me. This is the one thing that I think that Kasim Reed and Donald Trump have very much in common. Neither one of them lets a punch pass.
Yeah.
They're extremely devoted to counterpunching. If you hit them, they will hit you back.
You know what's interesting about this race, because we're not going to have to talk about it too much longer, and you just put your finger on it. Certainly the Democratic Party accused Mary Norwood of being a closet Republican, and it seemed to be an effective tactic against her. She denies it. She says she's a progressive independent. So you think about the values of the Democratic Party, inclusiveness, caring about the needs of minorities, that sort of thing. And yet, in this race, it was the Republicans, presumably, it was the loser, Mary Norwood, who put together the biracial coalition that she thought would win her the election. And yet, but at the same time, Keisha Lance Bottoms relied on a big turnout in the African American
community. Right, and Bottoms also had her biracial coalition. It's we're all talking about a matter of emphasis. The other part of that, of course, is we had Shirley Franklin siding with Mary Norwood, saying that character should be placed ahead of race.
Right, right. Okay, so this moves us toward just one comment, at least for now, about the Democratic race for governor. Stacey Evans, the white candidate facing Stacey Abrams for the Democratic nomination, she endorsed Keisha Lance Bottoms in this race. Presumably, her one signal for how she hopes to reach out to African Americans, I assume.
Right. And the more interesting thing here is that Stacey Abrams is the former House Minority Leader, is the other Democratic candidate in this contest, and she has been running a campaign very much based on intensifying the current Democratic constituency, going after unregistered African Americans, really diving down into getting African American women motivated, and firing up the Bernie Sanders wing,
yeah,
right there. Okay, that's kind of what Keisha Lance Bottoms did in the mayoral race. Okay, and it worked in Atlanta, which was 80%. Which was an 80% Hillary Clinton unit, but it only worked. It just barely worked, and she had a cushion of 759 votes.
Yeah.
And that tells me that maybe this strategy that she's pursuing it might not be effective in statewide politics.
Well, thank goodness for Political Rewind, Jim. There's another election just around the corner down there. 2018 is going to be a huge year. for us. By the way, you talked about Shirley Franklin. It's a fairly minor note in all this, but in the Political Insider blog at Politically Georgia, your blog at the AJC, a little item about the fact that Mary Norwood got caught videotaping a commercial on the grounds of Drew Charter School. She was not given permission to do it. And, of course, one of the ironies there is Drew Charter School, one of the founders of Drew Charter School, Mayor Shirley Franklin.
Exactly.
And apparently now they're looking and saying, we got security issues. We should never have allowed this to, or it shouldn't have been able to happen since we didn't give permission. All right, let's move on, if we can. We said at the very top of this show, Jim, that there are two prominent Georgians who have pushed back on Donald Trump in the last couple of days. One of them is, of course, Congressman John Lewis. In Jackson, Mississippi, they are about to open a new civil rights museum, and Mississippi's Republican governor invited President Trump to attend the opening ceremonies.
And Trump has accepted.
He has said he's going. And John Lewis's response has been,
well, if he's going, I'm not.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to be on the same stage with the president.
Yeah, he said, I think one of the things he said is, I cannot, my conscience would not allow me to be there with him. One of the things I find really peculiar about this is that when asked about this in the press briefing at the White House, Sarah Huckabee Sanders said, well, what a shame it is that he doesn't want to be there to honor those great civil rights leaders who fought for the cause. Well, who exactly is she talking about?
Yeah, not acknowledging the fact that museum probably has more John Lewis exhibits pound for pound than anywhere else in the country.
Yeah, I thought that was really a peculiar kind of way to deal with this thing. It will be interesting to see if the president does. Now that there's a real microscope on this event, if the president will go, even more interesting is the kind of remarks he'll make at this event.
And this is what, Saturday?
Yeah.
It's Saturday, and it comes right before Tuesday's vote in Alabama, which is next door.
Yeah.
And that could actually have some, you wonder if this is an attempt by Trump to kind of balance off the two events.
Well, we'll watch and report. On Monday, we'll be able to talk about what happens at the new Civil Rights Museum in Jackson, Mississippi. Sam Olens. How long? It's been 6 months, 7 months now?
I think he was appointed in spring.
Spring of
2016. Formally robed only last October.
Yeah. This past October.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he gives up the attorney general's office. And you've got to imagine he hasn't said it, I don't think, at least not to anybody at GPB, to me specifically. You've got to imagine he was really thrilled to be getting out of the cauldron of partisan politics.
Oh, he was
politics.
Thrilled, and we had at least one extended conversation about how comfortable he was at KSU and how nice it was to be able to escape the kind of the dynamics of a Republican primary.
So he gets caught up in the cheerleader kneeling incident. There is reporting by your colleagues at the AJC that suggests that he made a decision to keep the cheerleaders off the field during the anthem, and that perhaps it was motivated by pressure he got from the very conservative sheriff of Cobb County and from Legislator Earl Earhart, who sits as the chair of the subcommittee in higher education,
higher education spending.
That was going to be the next. And now the reports are, and then we learn that he violated what the Board of Regents had already told university leadership across the state. Here's how you have to handle the kneeling.
Right, right.
It happen, even though we don't like
right,
it.
Right, right. What we found was that the Board of Regents had anticipated
Kaepernick.
Thank you very much. Kneeling controversy, And they had sought and received an opinion from the AG's office saying, it doesn't matter. This is free speech. You cannot curtail that. These people are not precisely employees of a university system, and we don't call them employees.
And so the bottom line in all this is that this week there's reporting that suggests that Olens is probably out as head of Kennesaw State University.
Right. No one is saying precisely that, but we've received some very, very strong hints that they are trying to ease him out slowly, and there are people trying to find him in his next gig. It's a shame. It truly is a shame, because I thought he was. I personally thought he was a very, very good fit for that job.
You know, Olens is. If this is going to be the end of what is essentially his public career, I mean, I'm assuming, Jim, that I mean he's an attorney, obviously, and I would imagine that there are law firms in Metro Atlanta that would love to add him as a partner, if nothing else, to be a rainmaker for them, because his reputation has not been completely darkened by this.
No.
He's still well thought of in most
no,
circles.
He's been known as a fellow who can bring different sides together. I mean, he headed up the ARC for a good while. He was chairman of the Cobb County Commission. Especially as AG, he took some very fine stances on when it came to the First Amendment. He was always a good friend of the press,
which is one of the reasons that what happened at KSU is so incredibly ironic. He was never able to bring together the people who were critical of his appointment, saying that he wasn't qualified, saying that it was an insider job, no one else was looked at for the position. He walked into a controversy from the very beginning, and despite his credentials for knowing how to work across lines of divisiveness, he couldn't make that happen. And then a staunch defender of the First Amendment ends up being caught up in a controversy that seems to be the exact opposite.
Yeah, there's something just a little bit unusual with KSU when it comes to its relationship with the kind of the political hierarchy of Cobb County. The political elite there have always considered it kind of their property.
Yeah,
and they have called many of the shots that have occurred there.
I'll tell you what, why don't we get a break in? We got a lot more we want to talk about. Among other things, Speaker of the House David Ralston made an interesting comment to our friend over at WABE, Dennis O'Hare, about the whole controversy over Confederate memorials. We'll look at that. We'll look at the Al Franken situation. We'll look at another Georgia leader who pushed back against Trump this week, Chris Wray. The director of the FBI. All that ahead, you're listening to Political Rewind.
You count on GPB to bring you reporting that helps you better understand our world. And as 2017 comes to a close, we're counting on you. Listeners make the independent journalism and all the programs that you hear possible. As you support the organizations that matter to you, please remember how much you rely on GPB. Go to gpb.org and click donate to make your tax-deductible year-end gift. And thanks so much for your support.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. If you're just joining us on in real time, what is a very snowy Friday afternoon in Metro Atlanta, we've given our panelists the afternoon off so they can get home. Traffic has been fairly intense out there. And Jim Galloway and I are filling in today. And we didn't say, Jim, as we always try to do, that our listeners can read you in the Wednesday and Sunday edition of the paper. And you oversee Politically Georgia, the Political Insider blog.
Now, I am skipping this Sunday. I did yeoman's work earlier in this week, so
yeah.
So I'm skipping Sunday this today.
Good for you. But give a little preview of what's coming up on Monday. We're going to give you a chance to play book critic.
All right. All right, now? You want to do that now?
No. Oh, okay. Give us a preview. What are you going to do on Monday? You're going to share with us what?
I've got four books that I'm looking at. I've got a kind of a biography of Sam Nunn that's out there. And this is kind of your Christmas political list here, if you will. You've got the Sam Massell's new biography that's out. Also one on Newt Gingrich. The most interesting thing, I think, is a book called $10 to Hate. It's by Patricia Bernstein. Mm. It is a history of the second coming of the Klan.
Around 1920, I think.
1915, 1920, yeah. That period. And what's interesting is that she has discovered that the woman behind it, there was a female behind the rise of the second Klan. She was an Atlanta brothel keeper.
All right. Don't give any more away. This is a tease for Monday. You've got to get into the broadcasting rhythm here, Jim.
Is it Sweep Squeak yet?
Yeah. Let's talk about David Ralston. He went over and did an interview with Dennis O'Hare. And, one of the most interesting things he talked about, there is a movement. Of course, we know there is Georgia's statute, which forbids local communities, cities, other municipalities, counties, from on their own removing or changing, altering in any way Confederate memorials. That has to have the approval of the state.
Now, the legislature specifically.
Thank you. I assume that was put into place. It's been a while. That's an old statute.
This was part of the 2001 deal that Governor Roy Barnes cut to bring down the 1956 segregation-era state flag.
Right. Okay, so it's been around for 16-plus years.
Right.
But it also gives legislators who were opposed to that change in the flag the comfort to know that they will have, or the people who succeed them will have, the power to prevent this from happening across the state in local communities.
Right. But now the fly in the ointment here happened in August of this year. In Charlottesville, Virginia, there was a movement to remove a statue of Robert E. Lee, mm-hmm. and it became a symbol for white supremacists. We had a good 2-day violent clash. One woman killed protesting the supremacists. And so now you have local governments looking at this and saying, if we have markers that are becoming a rallying point for white supremacists or other undesirables, do we want that to happen? And shouldn't we have a say-so in that?
So, that is one of the most prominent communities in which that's happening is over in Decatur, DeKalb County, where they want to get rid of a Confederate memorial, definitely a lost cause style memorial right in the Decatur Town Square. Mary Margaret Oliver, State Rep Mary Margaret Oliver, is introducing legislation that will allow local municipalities to act independent of the state. David Ralston is pushing back.
Yeah. He had, in that interview with Dennis O'Hare, and I should say that Ralston has been making the rounds. I mean, he sat down with AJC reporters and editors, I think the day before that.
Yeah, and he'll be in here on Wednesday to talk to us. But
right,
go ahead.
Right. But Dennis had asked him about Mary Margaret Oliver's legislation, and Elena Perron on the Senate side is sponsoring that legislation as well. And the speaker said a very curious thing. He said that he would consider it divisive if you had one version of history in one community and another version of history in another one. It was kind of his signal that he's not looking favorably on that on changing that 2001 agreement.
What do you make of that?
Number one, I think that it's a swamp of an issue. It really is, and it can paralyze a legislature. It can eat up a whole lot of time in a 40-day session. The other thing you have to remember about is that we are still in active competition for the Amazon second headquarters, and to see the legislature explode over that might seem unseemly to if you're interested in economic development.
So I would add to that the possibility that Speaker Ralston is trying to protect his members in an election year.
If that too,
he early on makes it clear that he is not going to be supportive of legislation to change how Confederate markers of any kind are disposed of. He may be able to, as you kind of suggested, take it off the table early. It's certainly an issue you don't really want in the middle of campaigns for re-election.
What that is a symbol to House Committee Chairman that either this bill doesn't move or it gets slow walked.
Right. Here's what he said: If we, excuse me again, if we are a state, then we share the same history. The history of Georgia is the same whether you live in Blue Ridge or whether you live in Bainbridge or whether you live in Decatur. And so to allow that history to be controlled depending on the jurisdiction you're in strikes me as being divisive in and of itself. And then he says, I think we got to be very careful going forward.
And I think I wouldn't be too hasty to read anything ideological in this.
I think that's right.
The one thing you have to remember about Ralston, and we've mentioned it here before, is his background up in North Georgia. Many people in the state capital will point to ancestors who fought on the Confederate side. Ralston's people are from that North Georgia enclave where Union County is, of course, who fought for the Union. In essence, they seceded from the state of Georgia.
Yeah, I think that's right, and it's really fascinating. And although certainly David Ralston would not call himself this, he does live in what is a relatively progressive community surrounded by very conservative areas of the North Georgia Mountains.
Yeah. Blue Ridge has become this wonderful, wonderfully gentrified community.
That's exactly right. So your point is well taken. We should not assume that this in some way suggests that David Ralston is a staunch supporter of making sure Confederate monuments and other markers are kept in place.
I think what this is an acknowledgement that the solution to the dilemma is going to be very delicate, and it's going to have to occur over a number of years.
Okay. That's going to be interesting to see whether this will put the damper on Elena Parent and Mary Margaret Oliver's legislation. It won't stop them, but you're right, Jim. It may be slowed down in committee. We'll see how far it gets. Therefore, taking a very controversial issue off the table in the time of Amazon and as a re-election year approaches for all the members of the House and Senate. Want to talk about Al Franken a little bit?
Let's go.
All right. As most people who are paying attention to the news, and I know all of you out there are paying attention, yesterday Al Franken went to the floor of the United States Senate and announced it was time for him to step down.
I, of all people, am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party.
So that was the Al Franken soundbite that certainly got all of the big play yesterday, as it certainly should have, defiant to the last, not about the women. Franken said, essentially, I was shocked to realize that I had been behaving in a way that was so offensive to women.
But he also made a kind of a subtextual argument that he could have beaten these charges, that he could have stood up against them and survived.
He said, I know in my heart that I have done nothing to be ashamed of during my tenure in the United States Senate, and that the Ethics Committee would have come to realize that too. He also said, although he has certainly been apologetic on some of these charges or these accusations that have been presented about his behavior, he also said the other day, they're not all true. Some of these things I would say are not true. So he's going to step down. Why do we think... I was surprised he didn't just resign outright. Is it Simply that he's got a few more votes he wants to cast.
Yeah, I think number one, you don't want to deprive the Democratic side of a single vote at this point, especially when you've got a federal shutdown looming as early as December 22nd.
Yep,
and I'm not exactly sure of what the timing is going to be on the Minnesota side with getting the lieutenant governor appointed to the position to replace him.
Right. Okay, so it'll be soon. By the first of the year, he's going to have to...
It'll be soon. But I think it's worth noting that if you're trying to examine the pressure that he was under, number one, only a few days before that, you had the resignation of John Conyers, longest-serving Democrat in the House out of Michigan, also accused of sexual misconduct
and of paying off the women, settling with the women out of taxpayer money.
Right, right. Now, if Democrats were going to let them let Conyers be the only fall guy in this, that was number one. That was not good for party unity. So the white guy has to be thrown in there as well. But I also think and. What you've got is Democrats looking at this issue, looking at Roy Moore, looking at Donald Trump and the Hollywood Access tape, and realizing that there is just a tremendous issue hanging out there in the 2018 campaign season.
Okay, that's what I find. You know, when all of this began, it was certainly time for the women to come forward. There were a number of men who got caught up in this, whose behavior came back to haunt them. And Al Franken has to pay a price as well for the women who came forward because of the ways in which he harassed them. Abuse, I don't think he's accused of abuse, but harassment certainly. But this is starting to get turned into the most twisted and strange political calculus.
Well, I think his resignation was an attempt to simplify things.
Yeah, but okay, I get that. But if we say the Democrats went to him essentially and said, "You've got to get out of here. You're paying for Roy Moore's sins. If we don't take care of you, we can't go after Roy Moore," then, despite what may have been Franken's best motives and intentions, it becomes caught up in a political, partisan battle, which is what I was talking about.
It does. And I think you saw some of that attitude in his remarks.
Yes.
That he felt in many ways trapped by this.
Oh, go ahead. Finish what you're saying.
But what Democrats are trying to arrange is a scenario where they can say, look, we take care. We police ourselves. Republicans, they elect them.
All right. So you hear the Democratic side of that. I want you to hear. And Jim, I'm not sure if you've heard Newt Gingrich.
No, I have not.
So Newt Gingrich was on Fox News after the Franken resignation. Our old friend Newt, and father of Jackie Cushman, who we love as a panelist on this show. And here's how Newt Gingrich spun the Al Franken story, and we'll talk about this.
All of these nice people, none of whom have given back the money that they raised from Harvey Weinstein.
Weinstein.
None of whom have repudiated Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton. None of whom seemed offended in the past. Suddenly, in a paroxysm of moral outrage, create a lynch mob. And what you saw today was a lynch mob. Let's not have due process. Let's not ask anybody any questions. Let's not have any chance to have a hearing. Let's just lynch him. Because when we get done lynching him, we'll be so pure.
All right, Jim, I want to try to follow the logic of this. So Newt Gingrich says this is a Democratic lynch mob. Newt Gingrich, the Republicans on the Hill and many Republican leaders across the country don't want to be critical of Roy Moore because they want him as another vote in the Senate. So Gingrich, who could have taken this opportunity to say, well, Al Franken has stepped down, you know, reflecting upon what happens when women are harassed or abused by men. In the case of Roy Moore, he's accused of being a pedophile. isn't it time for Roy Moore to step down as well? And instead, what we get is an attack on the Democrats for taking action against a member of the party who has admittedly committed harassing behavior.
And that's why I'm saying the dynamics of 2018 is taking over this argument.
Yes.
And Newt Gingrich sees it, and he sees the trouble that his party is going to be in. I mean, we had, I hope maybe you can supply the name of the Arizona congressman who resigned yesterday.
Yeah. I don't. He is one of the more minor members of the House.
He's a minor member of the House, but he is resigning because he...
Trent Franks, Olivia Rheingold tells me.
Ah, thank you. Trent Franks. Okay, Mr. Franks resigned because he had approached female staffers in his office with the idea as surrogate pregnancies for he and his wife. We're talking Handmaid's Tale here.
Well... Yeah, that's right.
And he resigned. I'm sure he was encouraged by Paul Ryan's office to resign. That's a sign that even House Republicans know how explosive this is.
So here's what this was really a strange resignation coming out of the blue. Trent Frank said this: due to my familiarity and experience with the process of surrogacy, he and his wife have had a heart. They have not been able to have children.
Exactly.
And they've tried. So they've had a surrogate experience, and it hasn't worked. So he talked about it with Jeff. Due to my familiarity and experience with the process of surrogacy, I clearly became insensitive as to how the discussion of such an intensely personal topic might affect others. He goes on to say that he knows the Ethics Committee is looking into it. I deeply regret that my discussion of this option and process in the workplace caused distress. All right. This is such a peculiar accusation that he talked about surrogacy that I do think it's fair to wonder if another shoe is going to drop in this.
Yeah.
So the bottom line for me in all this is what began as an important and continues to be an important conversation about how men treat women has within
weeks
after all of this started, become a highly charged partisan political football, which doesn't do women any good.
Well, not so much as a political football as a very dynamic force in the political conversation. I mean, you've had Time Magazine declare that the hashtag #MeToo is its person of the year.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. Why don't we get another break out of the way? And as long as we're talking about all this, we can't avoid talking about Roy Moore in the Alabama Senate race. That election is next Tuesday, Galloway.
No recount there, I hope.
All right. You're listening to Political Rewind. We're going to take a quick break and be right back.
You're listening to Georgia Public Broadcasting, an 18-station radio network of GPB. Good afternoon. I'm Ellen Reinhart. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, a major contributor to the economic and cultural vitality of downtown Atlanta and the metro Atlanta area.
Homelessness in America is up for the first time in 7 years. And West Coast cities like Los Angeles are responsible for most of that increase. A booming economy means housing is more expensive.
I'm stuck here waiting on people who are supposed to be calling me. Oh, you're my next emergency case. It's been 3 weeks, and I'm still waiting.
I'm Kelly McEvers, One Woman Story, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 to 7 on GPB.
Welcome back to the Snow Jam edition of Political Rewind. If you're listening in real time, it's Friday afternoon, and Jim Galloway from the AJC and I are hunkered down in the Political Rewind studio, where we are taking up the load from the panelists who are going to be here and who, out of the goodness of his heart, producer Tom Faust said, stay home with your families. Don't try to come out in this weather. It's dangerous enough to be a political analyst in these times, but don't be driving while you're doing it.
Oh, let's see if we can get home after this.
From your lips to God's ears is the expression. Jim, let's talk before we talk about Roy Moore in Alabama. Let's come back to Georgia for a minute. The FBI director, Chris Wray, who was here in Atlanta. He was a federal prosecutor here, then went to work in private practice. He was at King and Spalding, one of the biggest and most successful law firm, most important law firms in the Southeast. Now he's up in Washington. And after President Trump this weekend made a series of statements, tweets, in which he thoroughly trashed FBI, saying it was in tatters, for instance. Chris Wray was on the Hill yesterday to testify about a number of matters, but he took advantage of the opportunity to say this.
There is no finer institution than the FBI and no finer people than the men and women who work there and are its very beating heart. What I can tell you is that the FBI that I see is tens of thousands of agents and analysts and staff working their tails off to keep Americans safe from the next terrorist attack, gang violence, child predators, spies from Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. The FBI that I see is people, decent people, committed to the highest principles of integrity and professionalism and respect.
So, Jim, you and I each, in listening to the list of things he gives the FBI a credit for working on, we picked up on different things. I heard Russian spies leading us right back to Russian interference in the election. You picked up on
the child predator line. Roy Moore.
Hey, Chris Wray is a smart attorney. And we are, of course, attributing to him something he may not have had in mind. But it was an interesting list, so I don't think it's a far supposition.
No, and it was an interesting appearance because he really did have to kind of walk the line between both House Democrats and House Republicans. I know he got into it a little bit with Hank Johnson over the question of whether the president is above the law, as mm-hmm. some of Trump's attorneys have hinted in the last few days. And you know, he said, look, I haven't studied that. That's not my problem. It's not my issue. And then he wasn't giving the answers that some House Republicans there was a threat there to hold him a warning that he was headed for contempt in some of the questions he wasn't addressing that House Republicans wanted addressed. Presumably, I think the Hillary Clinton emails.
Yes, exactly. Well, he spoke out. Jeff Sessions, the attorney general who oversees the operations of the FBI, Rod Rosenstein, the acting director of the Justice Department, said nothing in response to President Trump. And if you're in the Justice Department, it's got to be troubling to you that you're not getting Sessions, the attorney general, Rosenstein, who took Sally Yates's place, essentially, they're not speaking out defending their own agencies.
No, and this is, I mean, you know, you'd never had, I mean, in previous administrations and in the two Bush administrations and the Clinton and the Obama administrations, you didn't have, of course, there was kind of the invisible wall that stood between the White House and the Department of Justice, but you always felt that they were allied and on the same team. And now not only is that wall gone, but at least the first fellow, Jeff Sessions, may not be on your side if you're an individual FBI agent, or on Robert Mueller's staff. Although we had the number two there,
right,
express confidence in Mueller.
Right. Okay. Roy Moore. On this Friday, we're getting set to watch President Trump in Pensacola, Florida, which is geographically well positioned for him. Because it is in the Mobile, Alabama media market.
Right. And it might as well be Alabama.
Yeah. Yeah. So, we expect Trump will tonight, we'll watch what he has to say, but it's a shrewd move on their part. He can go in there. He can talk up Roy Moore all he wants to, and yet no one can accuse him of going into the state to support, Roy Moore's candidacy.
No, but but obviously there was more twittering today. In which he was unabashedly in favor of Roy Moore. Again, I think, you know, that you have to kind of look at that Friday appearance in Pensacola, the Friday appearance in Pensacola and Saturday appearance in Jackson, Mississippi at a civil rights museum. And you say, I wonder what's going on there. But as far as this race goes, is we're kind of down to the wire. You're seeing Doug Jones, the Democrat, kind of a little bit more accepting of last minute Democratic help. But he's being very careful about what help he asks for.
Yeah.
And what he's asking for, he's not looking for liberal white Democrats to come and help.
No, I think we have Sanford Bishop from down in the—
And John Lewis.
And they're both going in, African-American members of the delegation.
Right.
And that's,
if you think about that, that's kind of smart. That's more than kind of smart, because there's your messaging to African-Americans in the South isn't something that's going to overlap or contradict your messaging to white Americans until you get to this mailer that we—
You pointed this out to me. I had not seen this until you brought it to my attention. And it is a picture of a young African-American man with a kind of
a skeptical
look on his face. And the headline is, "Think if a black man went after high school girls, anyone would try to make him a senator?" And of course, we get that Doug Jones' only hope of winning this thing is to turn out African-American voters. This is one of those things like when you write an email and you don't hit send immediately, you think, maybe I should think about this for a while.
It was interesting. He was on Sirius Radio either early this morning or late yesterday, and he said, well, maybe the wording might have been a little bit off on that one.
Yeah, it's troubling. On the other hand, let's listen just for a second. Doug Jones has a commercial out, the Democratic candidate. Let's listen.
You know, folks, I'm going to say a couple of things that Roy Moore can't. Alabama needs its two senators working together, and I'll never embarrass you. I can work with Senator Shelby and Republicans better than Roy Moore can work with anyone. I'm asking you for the chance to do just that, to find common ground, get things done for you and your family, and make Alabama proud. I'm Doug Jones, and I approve this message because that's what matters in this election.
So, it's very, very lovely sentiment, but it strikes me the last thing in the world that Alabama voters want is somebody who's, you know, going to work across. I mean, I get it that if Doug Jones has to work with the Republicans, but they're not looking for kumbaya moments in the state of Alabama.
No. If you are a Republican, I think there's a Democratic pollster out there that was quoted in the New York Times. Maybe if not this week, maybe late last week, where he said if the Lord Jesus himself it came down and was a Democrat, he'd lose in Alabama.
So we really expect, I mean, anything can happen. We've both been around long enough to know that. But it is reasonable to imagine that Roy Moore will win this election on Tuesday.
Despite being accused of laying hands on a 14-year-old girl, even though it was four decades ago, and being accused of sexual assault by a 16-year-old and signing her yearbook, I think it would still be an upset if Doug Jones wins this race on Tuesday.
Mitch McConnell said last week, of course, the Republicans have now gone in whole hog.
With Trump's endorsement, you've had the RNC return its spending.
Although the NRSC has not. The Republican Senate Campaign Committee has refused to get in because that's money controlled by those guys on the Hill.
By Mitch McConnell, right.
So that's an interesting split. And McConnell does say, well, if he comes up here, if he wins, he's going to be immediately subjected to an ethics investigation. But, it puts those Republicans in a tough spot.
Specifically Johnny Isaacson, who chairs the ethics committee.
Yeah, exactly.
But it sets up this dialogue that we've been talking about this past hour for the 2018 campaign, that it's going to be on women are going to have a central role in this.
All right. We'll be here, of course, to talk about the results of the Alabama Senate race. Political Rewind will be on the air next Wednesday, as we will be, of course, Monday and Friday, too. Jim, one other quick note. We're running out of time, but Nydia Tisdale, the citizen journalist that we've talked about on the show a bit, who likes to go out and record public meetings, certainly her right as a citizen, has been on trial for the Burt Pumpkin Farm incident, in which she was told to stop videotaping. She didn't. State Republican leaders were up there. It was a big election rally. The jury came back and they dismissed the charges. They found her not guilty of the felony charges, but she was convicted on a misdemeanor charge, essentially of not complying, interfering with an officer.
And it's an interesting kind of distinction to make, because if you acquit someone of the original charges, usually the mitigating, the complicating charges are dismissed as well. In this case, the underlying charges have been dismissed, but you still have the interference one. And what this is an August 2014 incident. It was part of a series of GOP rallies featuring the entire ticket. Nathan Deal sat right behind Ms. Tisdale, and Ms. Tisdale is a videographer. She's a journalist, but she doesn't. All she does is she shows exactly what's in front of her. She offers no commentary, and she was focused on Ralph Hudgens, the insurance commissioner, who is well known for making gaffes. You had a couple of GOP people panic. It was on private property, public invited, but private property. And suddenly, the private property owners changed the rules.
Yes. There are those who are concerned that this conviction, even though it's on a misdemeanor charge, has some chilling effect on free speech. The whole incident itself suggests a chilling of the value of free speech.
It is. But I will also say that all politics is local, and that Ms. Tisdale has filed a civil suit seeking damages. And something like this the local authorities filed these criminal charges very, very late.
Yeah.
And after Ms. Tisdale served notice that she was going to file a civil suit.
Okay, the judge could sentence her to prison. If he puts her in jail for anything like that, that would be a shocking development, I think.
I'm hoping maybe she gets away with a $10 fine.
All right. Well, Jim, we are just about out of time. In a few minutes, we're going to have to go out there and test our fortitude.
I'm going to strap on my snowshoes.
Thank you so much, though, Jim, for being willing to come in here today.
You know who we should have had here? We should have had Kathy Woolard. I think
she's getting set to go up to the Arctic Circle.
Yeah, she wants to do the Iditarod or something like it.
Something like it. It's not the Iditarod. She's not a musher, but she is going to do some big physical event up in the Arctic Circle, which should be fascinating. Thank you, Jim Galloway, for being with us. We've got shows for you all next week. I just want to call attention to two highlights as we get out of here. First of all, on Wednesday at 2 o'clock, Speaker of the House David Ralston, who we've been talking about, will be on the show to talk about the upcoming session. And I want to make a quick note about Thursday for you country music lovers. Our annual holiday show with Christian Bush will be on Thursday. Christian writes Christmas music every year. He'll play some for us. But the big headline is he comes to us as Sugarland has announced they have gotten back together. He and Jennifer Nettles are recording new music. And we'll talk about that and more with him on Thursday. Thanks for being with us. See you again on Monday.